This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, November 16th, 2007. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns. In today's program, an Australian coroner says two Indonesian soldiers can be prosecuted for war crimes. A court ruling in Canada says U.S. war resisters in the country will not be given refugee status. And as Congress moves into Thanksgiving recess, two war funding bills fail to pass the U.S. Senate. All this and more, but first, these news headlines.
I'm Anitra Griselis with these headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Thousands of marchers surrounded the Department of Justice building to demand stronger federal prosecution of hate crimes. Catherine Jarmul reports from Washington.
The rally called for the federal government to intervene in hate crime cases that have not been prosecuted to the fullest extent at a local level. Speakers cited the recent Jenna 6 case, the hate crimes committed at the University of Maryland campus, and the police shooting of Sean Bell as examples of continued racial inequality in U.S. courts. Reverend Al Sharpton said police violence needs to be prosecuted at a federal level.
Police must not be allowed to sweep under the carpet when police commit crime. And the Justice Department needs to review police activity.
Judge Greg Mathis said the courts prosecute youth differently based on race.
Yesterday, the young white kid who burned up half of California, 68,000 acres, killed 11 people. They say he was playing with matches, so they're not going to prosecute him. It's called criminal negligence. And if they let him go but lock Michael Bell up for a year over a fist fight, that's injustice.
Steve Harvey, Martin Luther King Jr. III, and members of the Congressional Black Caucus also spoke at the rally. Newly appointed Attorney General Michael Mukasey issued a statement in response to the rally, saying the Department of Justice is committed to prosecuting hate crimes and eradicating hate in American society. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Catherine Jarmel.
The House of Representatives passed new surveillance legislation late last night with the support of all but five Democrats. It is an updated version of the Bush administration's Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA, that expires in February. The new bill allows for blanket wiretapping of named terrorist groups for 1 year. It includes additional protections for Americans living in the U.S. and abroad, requiring a court order for surveillance in most cases. The bill does not shield telecommunication companies from civil lawsuits, which have been filed against the companies for breaking wiretapping and privacy laws when they handed over customers' records to the government after September 11th. Finally, the bill provides no privacy protection for undocumented immigrants in the U.S. All but five Republicans opposed the bill. The Senate's version of the bill, which they will take up in December, does provide immunity for telecommunication companies. A committee of the United Nations General Assembly has approved a resolution calling for a global moratorium on executions. Human rights groups say it's one step closer to a more humane world. Haider Rizvi has more from the UN.
Despite strong opposition from a small but powerful group of countries, including the United States and China, a majority of UN member states yesterday endorsed a draft resolution calling for a temporary ban on executions. 99 countries voted in favor, 52 against, and 33 abstained. The General Assembly is expected to endorse the committee's decision in its plenary session in December. The resolution is non-binding, but carries moral weight. The London-based human rights group Amnesty International said the resolution is a major step towards the abolition of the death penalty worldwide. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Heather Rizvi at the United Nations.
A cyclone with 150-mile-an-hour winds pounded southern Bangladesh late last night. Nearly 500,000 people have been evacuated. Shakil Ahmed has more from Bangladesh.
Officials say at least 650 people have died, though unofficial sources say the number could be as high as 1,700, with some 15,000 missing. Among those missing are the inhabitants of the island Dugdat Jor, where witnesses say the tide rose some 10 to 15 feet. Much of Bangladesh, including the capital city, is in the dark. Power lines and the phone lines are down in many areas. Roads are washed out. With electric water pumps down, millions of people are facing water shortages. But experts say, so far, the cedar has been less devastating than the cyclone that hit in 1972, which left 500,000 people dead. For Free Speech Radio News, Shakil Ahmed from Bangladesh.
Those are today's headlines. From KPFA in Berkeley, I'm Anitra Grisalis.
Pakistani President General Pervez Musharraf's appointment of a caretaker government late last night has drawn immediate criticism from leaders of the opposition. They claim that free and fair elections are impossible under martial law because political parties are not permitted to organize, and over half of Pakistan's higher judiciary has been fired. Musharraf's efforts to stay in power for another term hit yet another snag today as three of his hand-picked Supreme Court judges have recused themselves from hearing legal challenges to the imposition of martial law. From Pakistan, Devin Terrio Orr reports.
Musharraf's choice for prime minister is Mohammad Mian Somro, who was the chair of the Senate and is currently the leader of Musharraf's faction of the Pakistan Muslim League, the PMLQ. Hassan, a lecturer from Punjab University who asked that he be identified under a pseudonym because of his political activities, challenged the legitimacy of the caretaker government.
Given that there are thousands of lawyers in jail, given that, you know, political leadership of the political opposition, political parties are in jail, anything that Musharraf does or anyone that he appoints automatically gets discredited. So caretaker government, fine, but again, the caretaker government is still under Musharraf. No one will accept anything that has Musharraf's backing.
Deep Saeeda, a pro-democracy activist, expressed doubt about whether the caretaker government would be able to hold fair elections without a free judiciary.
In this kind of martial law and emergency, this is a joke to announce a caretaker government. The prime minister, he announced, is a leader of his own political party, Pakistan Muslim League Q group. And how you can, when there is no courts, how you can expect that we will have a fair election?
Musharraf continues to state that elections will be held under martial law, even though public meetings are banned and many political workers are jailed. Attorney and Pakistan People's Party spokesman Khurram Latif Khosa rejects Musharraf's plans.
We are thinking of boycotting the elections. We will not accept any elections under the rule of emergency.
On the eve of American envoy John Negroponte's arrival, Musharraf is making concessions to deflect international criticism. In an indication that he may be finally preparing to relinquish his uniform, Musharraf amended the provisional constitutional order to allow a civilian president to make future amendments. Khosa comments.
The chief of army staff, mind you, is General Pervez Musharraf. And the so-called president is also General Pervez Musharraf. Now he says that he himself is delegating the power to himself to lift the emergency whenever he feels like. It's a joke.
Musharraf has also unblocked access to most international and domestic television channels and has released Benazir Bhutto and human rights activist Asma Jahangir from house arrest. Bhutto has promised to call an all-parties opposition conference after reconciling with her former rival, exiled PM Nawaz Sharif. But many Pakistanis, such as Deep, remain critical of Bhutto's actions.
Now she's compromised with this dictator just to save herself from the corruption charges. This is ridiculous, and United States should realize that people are not so stupid in this country. People are aware of the situation and all the deals and hidden agendas.
But the fight against dictatorship will not end with Musharraf, according to Hassan.
For the people of Pakistan, the fight is about dictatorship and democracy. And when we say dictatorship, it is not just Musharraf. We're talking about military dictatorship. We're talking about an institution which has more or less hijacked the country. So the fight is against them. And they have basically used the whole extremist discourse to present to the West that the fight is about extremism and enlightened, so-called enlightened moderation.
Despite Musharraf's efforts to restore order, protests have continued around the country. 3,000 students protested at Punjab University today, and there are plans for an all-student conference next week. In Karachi last night, five PPP members, including two children, were killed by police, while hundreds were arrested. With more protests planned and international pressure mounting, Musharraf has a rough road ahead. For FSRN, this is Devin Terrio Orr in Lahore.
Two former Indonesian soldiers could be prosecuted for war crimes following the release of an Australian coroner's report today. The subject of the report was Brian Peters, one of five journalists killed in Balibo and East Timor in 1975. The coroner said there was sufficient evidence that the killing of Peters, along with newsmen Malcolm Rennie, Greg Shackleton, Gary Cunningham, and Tony Stewart, was deliberate. She said the murders constituted war crimes, and she's referred the cases to the country's top courts. Erica Voles reports from Sydney.
The findings today overturned an official line pushed by Indonesia and accepted by Australia for 32 years, which claimed that the newsman died in crossfire between independence forces and the Indonesian military. At the time, Indonesian forces were launching raids into East Timor in the lead-up to invasion later that year. Shirley Shackleton, whose husband Greg was one of those killed, welcomed the findings.
Oh, it's like a dream come true, and I felt that all the years of pain and suffering, I'm not talking about myself, you know, I'm talking about even the children, even the politicians who, because of the vile practices of foreign affairs officials, were forced to lie and have gone on year after year after year with the lie. Everybody has suffered.
Many have argued that the need to preserve the Indonesian-Australian relationship at all costs has had a bearing on several previous inquiries into the deaths, which all supported the Indonesian version of events. Shackleton and others have long suspected the Australian government knew more about the deaths than it admitted. Witnesses before the inquest claim to have read transcripts of intercepts obtained by Australian intelligence, which included discussions about killing the journalists and disposing their bodies. However, the physical transcripts were never presented to the inquest, and for this reason, the coroner cleared the Australian government of prior knowledge of the deaths. John Milkins, the son of murdered cameraman Gary Cunningham, said that while the coroner was brave, more needed to come out.
I remain convinced that there is still material that's unavailable and that hasn't been given to the evidence that was beyond the terms of reference of the inquiry. And I'm sure that at some point in the future that evidence will come out unless it's been destroyed already.
Journalist Hamish McDonald covered the story in 1975 and has followed its trail throughout his career. He says that black holes in the evidence on what the Australian government knew at the time point to a failure by intelligence services to protect their records.
And I think it's a lesson for the intelligence services that they must preserve their materials. It is a legal duty punishable by prison if they don't, and recognise that they are not serving the government of the day or some nebulous international intelligence community, but that they have a duty to the Australian people and to Australian history.
The Australian Attorney General has agreed to pass on the case to the Australian Federal Police and the Director of Public Prosecutions. Any case would be highly damaging to the Australian-Indonesian relationship, and an Australian trial would require suspects to be extradited from Indonesia, a highly unlikely event. Asked whether Indonesia would recognise Australian jurisdiction over a case that Jakarta has refused to participate in, spokesperson for the Indonesian Embassy in Australia, Dino Kusnadi, queried whether an Australian court would have the necessary jurisdiction.
Our position still stands at this moment that from the Indonesian side that the case of the Balibo 5 is closed.
International law expert Ben Saul maintains Australia does have the jurisdiction to try the Indonesians for war crimes. And he says that an attempt at extradition by Australia might be enough to force a case within Indonesia.
Under the treaty, if you don't extradite your nationals, then there is an obligation under the treaty to submit the case to your own domestic prosecutors.
The coroner has also recommended that the remains of the five men, who were hastily buried in Jakarta shortly after their deaths, be returned to Australia. This is Erica Voles in Sydney reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
The U.S. Senate failed to pass two Iraq war funding measures today. One was offered by the Republicans and would have provided $70 billion for the president to continue to fight the war. It received 45 votes in support. The Democratic version received 53 votes, still short of the 60 votes needed to pass. The legislation would have provided the president with $50 billion for the war, but also included a date to begin troop withdrawal. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid says he will not provide the president with any more funding until next year. As a result, the president may have to pull money from the Pentagon budget.
How much more could we do than say, Mr. President, if you need the money, here it is. But just let us have a little accountability for the American people. He said no.
Republican Senator John Kyle of Arizona says Republicans will not allow the Democrats to provide funding linked with withdrawal provisions.
At some point, we're going to need the funding for the troops. We cannot continue to condition funding for the troops on the Democratic proposals on withdrawal dates that all of our military leaders have said are not only unrealistic, but would do harm to the ability of our troops to carry out their mission.
Meanwhile, in Canada, the Supreme Court is seemingly putting on a good show of supporting the Iraq War by not supporting U.S. war resisters. Yesterday, Canada's Supreme Court declined to hear an appeal of a federal court ruling that war resisters Jeremy Hinsman and Brandon Huey could not claim refugee status on the basis that the Iraq War is illegal. This undermines the refugee claims of nearly 50 U.S. war resisters who expect to be prosecuted in the United States for refusing to fight in Iraq. From Vancouver, Zach Badorf tells us the story of one U.S. Army war resister who deserted his unit in Colorado Springs in September.
When Private Second Class Brad McCall attempted to cross the U.S.-Canada border into Canada on September 19th, Canadian border officials discovered the felony warrant out for his arrest for deserting his unit. So the 20-year-old infantryman said he wouldn't be entering as a visitor, but as a refugee claimant. For changing his story, he was arrested and imprisoned in a jail near Vancouver for 2 nights for misrepresentation of his intentions. When charges were dropped 2 days later, the Alabama native had a question for the border guards.
So when did you, Canadian civil servants, start taking orders from the U.S. Army and acting like their hound dog? And to this, they didn't have an answer.
Yesterday's decision by Canada's top court sets an unwelcome precedent for McCall and an estimated 250 other war resistors living in Canada. Jeffrey House represents 40 of the conscientious objectors. He says this decision has significantly harmed the cases of several of his clients. There's another more remote option of getting a special permit from Canada's immigration minister, but Diane Finley has said in a statement that she expects refugee claimants who have exhausted legal avenues to respect our laws and leave Canada. Meanwhile, Brad McCall is in limbo. With a history of military service in his family, McCall said he was gung-ho about serving his country. Then he learned what was going on in Iraq.
Well, basically, people were telling me about atrocities they had committed while in Iraq, and stories about people being shot for no good reason just because they were out too late, you know, after curfew or whatever. They would just shoot them. Or stories about little kids being run over with Bradley tanks. And that's when I started having feelings about the honor and the dignity and the romance of the military life kind of just melted away.
The United States Consul General to Canada has questioned the motives of the resistors, saying it's a little hard to declare conscientious objector status after signing up, taking the benefits and the salary. John Ney noted that there hasn't been a draft in the U.S. in 35 years. Ney said the deserters will be treated fairly. American consular officials in Vancouver and Ottawa, however, declined to speak to FSRN for this story, referring questions to the U.S. Army and suggesting we consult someone within the Canadian government on this matter. McCall now lives in the home of health policy analyst Colleen Fuller. She said there's been a notable shift in the past few years in the way the Canadian government works with the American government in cracking down on dissent.
And I would characterize our government as very similar to the Howard government in Australia, that we will kowtow at the American altar. And there has just been a long drawn out mea culpa on the part of the Canadian government because of the stance that we took on the Iraqi war and our involvement in Iraq.
Fuller cited the recent case of anti-war protesters Mehdia Benjamin and retired U.S. Army Colonel Anne Wright. Both were turned away from Canada after trying to cross because of their past arrests at anti-war protests. Alison Bodine, a U.S. citizen who lives in Canada, had her own troubles at the border. Canadian border officials barred her from Canada for 2 years for misrepresentation after trying to enter Canada with anti-war materials. McCall, for his part, said at best he hopes to get just a discharge and to leave his military history behind.
We are facing possible unfair treatment in the United States. They should take us in. They should grant us this status.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Zach Badorf in Vancouver.
In this week's political roundup, we bring you the highlights and the lowlights of last night's Democratic presidential debate. For the past few weeks, the media has been focusing on the candidates' verbal attacks on each other. Last night's debate fed into that media cycle, attempting to evoke confrontation among the leading candidates. But instead, it resulted in a verbal rejection by the audience. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
One of the fastest-growing cities in the country, an entertainment oasis, Las Vegas is located in an early primary and a swing state. The CNN-hosted debate, sponsored by the coal industry, started the debate with targeted and divisive questions. This one to Senator Hillary Clinton on her gender-specific references in recent weeks.
This pantsuit, it's asbestos tonight.
Moderator Wolf Blitzer posed the next question to Senator Barack Obama.
Because you've been among those critical of Senator Clinton, you've suggested she's triangulating.
What the American people are looking for right now is straight answers to tough questions. And that is not what we've seen out of Senator Clinton on a host of issues, on the issue of driver's licenses.
That led to a back and forth between Senators Obama and Clinton for 6 minutes. John Edwards, who has been critical of Senator Clinton, joined in, which resulted in a three-way conversation for nearly 9 minutes, ignoring the other four candidates. At last, Senator Joe Biden was asked a question, not of issues, but about Democratic bickering.
Senator Biden to weigh in. Senator Biden.
No.
I want you to weigh in.
Don't make me speak.
Eliciting laughter from the crowd, it was clear Las Vegans wanted to hear from all the candidates. But they did not want to hear any more comparisons to Clinton, even as Edwards responded to a question targeting her.
Senator Clinton defends the system, takes money from lobbyists, does all those things. And my point is simply that people have, voters have those choices. Voters have those choices, and they deserve to know that they have those choices and that there are, in fact, differences between us.
Some clear differences between the candidates did arise. Senator Obama said he would raise the cap on Social Security above $96,000, something Senator Clinton rejects.
Understand that only 6% of Americans make more than $97,000 a year. So 6% is not the middle class. It's the upper class. And, you know, this is the kind of thing that I would expect from Mitt Romney or Rudy Giuliani, where we start playing with numbers. We start playing with numbers in order to try to make a point.
First of all, I think that you meant a tax increase because that's what it would be.
Senator Clinton was forced to explain her position on Iran using sanctions before diplomacy. Senator Biden said he would move to impeach the president should he invade Iran. And Representative Dennis Kucinich advocated impeachment while he targeted some of his rivals for changing their position on the war, the Patriot Act, and free trade with China.
Just imagine what it will be like to have a president of the United States who's right the first time. Just imagine. And I don't think that the first questioner's question was really answered about what are you going to do about this president. And for that matter, the vice president, because they're out of control, and the Congress isn't doing anything.
Thank you, Congressman.
It's called impeachment, and you don't wait. You do it now.
All right.
You don't wait.
Senator Chris Dodd says not enough time has been spent on education in these debates.
This is the most important issue. Every other issue we grapple with depends upon our ability to have the best educated generation we've ever produced.
Senator Obama and Governor Bill Richardson are the only two candidates to support driver's licenses for undocumented immigrants. Here's Governor Richardson's response.
I did it 4 years ago. My legislature sent me a bill. I signed it. My law enforcement people said it's a matter of public safety.
Former Senator Mike Gravel was not allowed to participate because he lacked both money and support. so he held a forum for press and a small audience across the street from the Las Vegas debate venue. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
A Question of Impeachment is a five-week event sponsored by the New York City-based Culture Project. Each week, a different article of impeachment will be addressed by figures in the fields of journalism, entertainment, the military, and academia. The series asks whether the president should be impeached and what individuals should do when their representatives won't act. FSRN correspondent Zoe Sullivan sat in on a Culture Project rehearsal and has this report.
I think that twixt the Negroes at the South and the women at the North, all talking about rights, the white men will be in a fix pretty soon.
The words of Sojourner Truth, delivered in the new play Rebel Voices, adapted for the stage by Rob Urbinati from Voices of a People's History of the United States. The play is the opening night event for a five-week-long arts and discussion series called A Question of Impeachment that fundamentally asks, when is it time for a people to take back a government that is not adequately providing for the needs of its people? Rebel Voices explores this question by offering space to some of history's avatars. Howard Zinn, historian and author of A People's History of the United States, talks about his hopes for the play.
So we hope it will inspire people to understand that they have the power to change things and that they mustn't depend on elected representatives to bring about social justice or to end a war.
For more than 10 years, the Culture Project has been using theater as a way of bringing political issues to public attention. Every Monday, over the next 5 weeks, a new potential article or reason for impeachment will be presented. The articles are Initiation and Continuation of Illegal War, Torture and Extraordinary Rendition, Criminal Negligence and Hurricane Katrina, Warrantless Surveillance, and Consolidation of Executive Power. On Monday, November 19th, former federal prosecutor Elizabeth De La Vega will question retired Colonel Ann Wright and former CIA officer Ray McGovern about the president's conduct on Iraq. Afterwards, the audience will discuss whether his actions could prompt impeachment and what they could do if Congress won't act. Alan Bushman, the artistic director for the Culture Project, talks about the motivation for presenting the arguments for impeachment.
Maybe it's not the right thing for the country, but it's certainly the right thing for the country to be asking these questions and to have a public dialogue about the crimes that have been committed or the departure from the rule of law.
Anthony Arnove describes the connection between the play, Rebel Voices, and the impeachment project.
Rebel Voices, as we see it, is not about history, but it's about today as reflected through U.S. history. And right now we're in a moment in history where I think we can learn from those people who've spoken out in the past.
49 years have passed since the first settlers penetrated the land.
Stacy Ann Chin was the voice of Bartolomé de las Casas, a Spanish Dominican priest who, appalled by the torture of indigenous people, became an advocate for their rights. Chin, a cast member of Rebel Voices, talks about the need for radical change.
What has this generation got to lose? I mean, they don't have access to education because they can't pay for it. Young black boys are in jail, so they're in jail anyway. So, I mean, you know what it is? The individualism has to stop. We have to be concerned for the people who will come out of our bodies who are a generation or two or three or four behind us. We need to start looking out for each other. I might have enough to pay my rent, but somebody else doesn't, who works all week, 10-hour days. That's not right, and it is my duty to stand and say that's not right, even if it means I might lose my rent.
A Question of Impeachment opens this Sunday at the Culture Project in New York City. It can also be heard online at podango.com. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Zoe Sullivan in New York.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.